They wrote me off. I ain't right back, though. That's the problem. I ain't right back. Let's go.
You watch him now on the screen, having the time of his life.
All I have to say is, let's ride.
Don't you ever talk about me.
Who was talking about you?
The Brian Suits Show.
Well, good morning. So good to be with you today. My name is Tim Gatos, guest hosting for Brian Suits today. Thank you so much for being with us. Hope you had a great weekend. I tell you, today's a big day. The Supreme Court is considering today whether banning homeless people from sleeping outside when shelter space is lacking amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The case is considered the most significant to come before the high court in decades on homelessness, which, of course, is reaching record levels in the United States, here in Washington, California, other Western states in particular. Courts have ruled that it's unconstitutional to find and arrest people sleeping in homeless encampments if shelter space is lacking. And now a cross-section of Republican and Democratic officials contend that it makes it difficult for them to manage encampments, which can have dangerous and unsanitary living conditions. I think that's a understatement without a doubt. Hundreds of advocacy groups, though, are arguing that allowing cities to punish people who need a place to sleep will criminalize homelessness and ultimately make the crisis worse. And now the Supreme Court is going to rule this case. It comes from the rural Oregon town of Grants Pass, which started fining people $295 for sleeping outside to manage homeless encampments that sprung up in the city's public parks as the cost of housing escalated. And of course, the measure was struck down by the San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court. Now it's going to be going to the Supreme Court. They're going to decide today, and this could be a significant, significant decision, and which could help Seattle tremendously, could give Mayor Harrell and other leaders the opportunity to do some of the things that they've, I think, wanted to do, which is to really help move people indoors and be able to satisfy this crisis that we're seeing. But I tell you, it is a going to be a huge decision that's going to come down from the Supreme Court. And I think it's going to greatly, greatly help what's happening on our streets. Of course, downtown Seattle, which once boasted bustling streets, it was thriving. And you know, if you go down there now, of course, it's a gallery of despair dominated by drug addicted homeless who take over street corners. And I tell you, this could be a significant decision that comes down to help our region, help Seattle. And we will certainly keep you posted on that. We are seeing many retailers that are been leaving. Lululemon just announced recently they're leaving Pacific Place, which they've been there for many years. And by the way, Pacific Place is just a ghost town at this point. I was just there the other day. I didn't even recognize that place. That was one of the places you used to go quite a bit and take the family down there and like, oh, let's go have a downtown day. And now yeah. it's a ghost town.
Yeah, thanks for being here this morning, Tim. Always love it when you fill in. My wife and I went to Westlake just the other day. I used to park at Pacific Place and work on Olive Way for years and years. But when we were driving through Westlake, my wife used to frequent that area more than I did. She was able to point at all these vacant buildings. Oh, that used to be that. That used to be this. That used to be that. And instead, it was just taken over by the homeless population. And it looked fairly sketchy, whether you looked left, right, forward or backwards. And it was very sad to see a once thriving a part of town, you know, full of dynamism and commerce and a population going about their business, to just see it overrun with lawlessness and homelessness. It was terrible.
One of the things that I think has, Greg, won the day, and that's the narrative around this, and because we just, without even thinking about it, we say it's the homeless crisis. And that has the progressives on the, I think, far left have won out on this, because how you brand something, how you tell the story, what the narrative is so important in this. And so the fact that most of us say the homeless crisis without even batting an eye shows that they have won kind of the storytelling of this.
Well, at least you're not saying temporarily unhoused.
Right. Yeah. But they've won the story on this, because let's be honest. I mean, and I've worked in this space a number of years ago, and I don't want to, you know, generalize, but I would say that maybe 25 to 30% of folks on their street today are kind of the traditionally homeless who really are in need, who have lost a job and they need a lot of, they need help and assistance. And then there's a very large percentage of folks who are not, who do not fit that traditional homeless position in their life, where they really have, you know, they've succumbed to crime, they've succumbed to violence, to drug addiction. And I think in a lot of ways, the drug addiction has played a part in where they're at today. And as we've seen in many of our park encampments, many, many really don't have a desire to enter back into society into a profitable, helpful way. And of course, services are needed for them. But a lot of times accountability is incredibly important, too. And that's a word that has gotten a lot of, you know, noses turned down in our society. But I tell you, accountability is incredibly important. Compassion is important. But, Greg, compassion says yes and no. Compassion says yes and no.
It also depends on how you define compassion, too, because people have different working definitions of that loaded phrase as well.
Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of times right now we're just like, hey, we're going to just go ahead and just say yes. If you want to do whatever you want to do, you want to commit crime, you want to, you know, live in a place where it's illegal to live, we're going to let you do that. But really, if we want to help folks in need, compassion says no. And a lot of times that means you need rehabilitation. You need to go to jail. You need to. You know, be able to take responsibility for the things that are happening in your life. But I tell you, Greg, we're going to see today what's going to go on with this U.S. Supreme Court. It is going to be fascinating to see what happens. Hey, over the weekend, oh my goodness, out in Spokane, Washington, we had the Washington GOP convention. They hadn't gathered since 2016, and many were describing it as chaotic, although Jim Walsh, who's the Washington chair of the GOP, he pushed back quite a bit on this notion that it was chaotic. And he said, you know, the mainstream media, they're putting it out there that it was a bunch of kids getting together and yelling at each other. And that's just not what happened. And there's many, many examples of a chaotic convention. And hey, I wasn't there. I don't know, but we do have some audio.
Yeah, this is just a taste of some of what went down over in Spokane in no particular order.
The candidate committee determined that Semi Bird was not forthcoming in the vetting interviews.
Are we for supporting Bird or are we not? This last count is very confusing. Well, I've noticed a lot of people that had their hands up, but now they don't have their hands up. So me, myself, I'm not sure exactly what's going on.
The committee has voted to pull the governor's race from the ballots, and we will not be endorsing a governor at this convention.
Tomorrow we can still amend the ballot for the vote to include both Semi, he will be voted on, and any write-in candidate who people want to write in. So if people want to vote for Dave, even though he withdrew in, we can do it.
In light of some information, the candidate committee determined that Semi Bird was not forthcoming in the vetting interviews.
That was over the last few days in Spokane, the Grand Ole Party, the GOP convention. And as expected, they ended up endorsing Semi Bird for governor on Saturday with more than 70% of the roughly 1,800 delegates backing him over former congressman and King County Sheriff Dave Reichert, who never showed up. Reichert withdrew his endorsement bid on Friday, and he was slamming the Republican Party event as chaotic and a deceitful sideshow. And that was what happened on Friday. And then things calmed down a little bit on Saturday. And that's, you know, some of the top state GOP officials, they did spark a loud protest. We just heard a little bit about that when they unsuccessfully tried to disqualify Byrd for an endorsement over what they termed a lack of candor about his past legal problems. And then Saturday, it got a little calmer. They went on to endorse Bird. He was greeted by huge cheers. The crowd was fired up. He acknowledged his past struggles, including the federal misdemeanor bank larceny conviction from 1993, which GOP officials cited in trying to disqualify him, saying he should have disclosed it earlier in the party's candidate vetting process. Byrd said, "If you want me to apologize for falling, if you want me to apologize for making mistakes in life, I will apologize. I will take ownership, but I will not live in shame for the rest of my life for the sins of my past." He pledged, if elected, to call for the third-party audit of state government programs to end the sanctuary policies for undocumented immigrants and to fully support police. So we have a very interesting conundrum here. We have Dave Reichert, who, in all intents and purposes, I think is the most viable to be able to be the first Republican governor since John Spellman in 1980 to take Olympia. For Republicans, I mean, I think if you're looking at who has the best shot, I would think that Dave Reichert does. Many believe that Semi Byrd is the best candidate. Of course, according to the Washington State Republicans, he took over 70% of the endorsement. And it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out, because to be able to win the governorship here in Washington, King County, of course, is such the hub of population. You have to be able to win a decent amount of the votes, independent votes. You got to be able to win some of the moderate Republican votes. You got to, maybe you can even spill over some of the King Democrat votes here in King County, those who are not totally thrilled with the push of Democrats to the far left. Dave Reichert seems to be the one that could probably do that. I don't think Semi Byrd can win. I just don't think Semi Byrd can win. I think he's going to have a very tough time taking enough votes to be able to take Olympia. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because I think Dave, this could end up playing in Dave Reichert's favor. You know, recently he came out and you saw the video where he said, you know, marriage is between one man and one woman. Ferguson used that as a attack ad against Reichert, and they're trying to paint him as a closet far right Christian nationalist or something like that. But I tell you, you see the fact that the Republican Party isn't backing Reichert could actually be here in Western Washington a feather in his cap a little bit. He could actually use that when he's here in King County and say, "Hey, look, even the Republican Party isn't voting me. I'm kind of a maverick, so to speak." The old term that John McCain used to use. I'm a maverick.
So it's well known that Semi Byrd is the Trump candidate in Washington's governor's race, right? And Trump has about one third or so of the Republican Party that is just diehard ride or die Trump fans, right? And so you're saying this might work in Dave Reichert's favor if he appeals more to independents and even those who might be progressive in some sense but have some right leanings. Does that group of people make up for that one third that would not go with Reichert because they're loyal to Trump's candidate Byrd? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that a little convoluted?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the only chance it helps him is if somehow the Republican base coalesces around Reichert eventually, right? If he ends up being kind of the nominee on the general election side,
right,
then and the Republican base can coalesce around Reichert and say, hey, you know, kind of like, you know, Bernie Sanders and, you know, Biden or whatever it was, right? You had kind of the Bernie Sanders crowd, but ultimately the Democrat base coalesced around the general candidate. If that happens here, right?
But traditionally, that's what happens within parties.
Right.
We're in many ways, we're still kind of in uncharted territory.
Exactly.
With various competing loyalties. And it's a little different landscape, but I do see what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just saying if in those ways, in the traditional way, if the Republican base ends up coalescing around Reichert, that certainly does play in Reichert's favor. Because, again, I think my opinion, for Reichert to win, he needs to pull off that independent, moderate Republican or moderate Democrat vote to win here in Washington. You can't win with just we know that, right? That's why a Republican hasn't won the governorship since 1980. You can't win that with just the Republican vote. You've got to be able to siphon off in the independent and maybe even some Democrats. And so I think this is a builds his resume a little bit in that realm. And I think that could play, especially in light of the fact that just a week ago he was getting this news around, you know, this video about a marriage between marriages between a man and a woman. And so then you had the independents saying, oh man, Riker, maybe he is just what Bob Ferguson is saying he is. So he's in a little bit of a, you know, there's this conundrum. There's a little bit of a pickle for him. And really for the Republicans who say he's a rhino, right? Or Republicans who say, well, he's not really conservative enough. Actually, some of the video that came out with his comments could certainly also help his case from that standpoint. So he's in it. There's a number of layers that are happening right now that are going to be fascinating to see how they play out. But you're not of the mind that this is going to help him.
I don't know. I just think, again, Trump's impact on the GOP party nationally, I think is going to be problematic because there is a bit of a divide amongst conservatives and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So.
Yeah. Hey, the decade-long failure of Seattle progressives to solve its homelessness emergency continues to impact suburban King County. In Redmond, you heard about this Plymouth project that's going on in the first wave of this Seattle moving homeless individuals into the suburbs. Of course, this started during COVID. King County Executive Dow Constantine spent approximately $400 million to purchase 11 hotels around the county to obtain 1,600 rooms. That's $250,000 per housing unit. This was the Health Through Housing project. This included locations in Auburn, Federal Way, Kirkland, Redmond, Renton. Nearly all these hotels, they are purchased without community input. Many received strong public protests due to the proximity to preschools, the expected financial drain on city services. Then there's a second wave. And, you know, the region is currently experiencing the second wave now of moving Seattle's, you know, quote unquote, homeless individuals into suburban communities. And this effort is being led by Plymouth Housing. And this is a long-term receiver of government housing funds. You probably remember Washington State Speaker of the House, Frank Chop, who recently is you know, resigned, very prominent, and he has pushed millions of dollars to Plymouth. That this Plymouth housing plan, it was rejected by the city of Kenmore. Last time I was here on the program, we talked a little bit about that. That was rejected by Kenmore last January. And you know, Plymouth was just not forthcoming about some of the issues around this facility. The housing organization, they immediately then struck a deal with Redmond Mayor Angela Burney. And this was a coalition of, you know, Governor Inslee kind of coming to Redmond Mayor and say, we got to do something about this because this does not look good on what we're trying to do. They obtained a $7 million parcel of land in the center of the city's retail district. And they also got $3 million more in city services. Many Redmond residents were shocked by the mayor's secret deal, especially since the location, it's just a couple blocks from Redmond Elementary and a block away from Anderson Park. Safe Eastside, it's a volunteer group battling the mayor and city council's fast track of this project. The group says, man, the Kenmore project, it took 2 years to study Plymouth's plan, and now you're just trying to ram this thing through. So Redmond citizens, they are coming together, and you may have heard or seen some of the protests that they've had out at City Hall at Redmond. I mean, hundreds of people have been coming out to protest this and say, we've got to have community input. We've got to talk about this project because this could demonstrably affect the area around here and bring crime, bring violence. Of course, got Redmond Elementary right here. We've seen this on several occasions. So we'll continue to talk about this, but I'm Tim Gatos. I'm filling in for Brian Suits today. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Brian Suit Show. I'm Tim Gatos, guest hosting for Brian today. Thanks so much for being with us. So glad you're here. Got a great program for you. You know, there's a lot of people saying, hey, things have turned the corner here in Seattle in the Northwest, and crime is getting better. It's decreasing. But new statistics out show that is not the case. In fact, just the other day, I don't know if you heard about this random crime that happened at the Muckleshoot Casino. A 29-year-old man, he was killed in a random stabbing inside the casino early Sunday morning. He was just at a gaming table, sitting there, and a random person approached him, stabbed him in the neck, and killed him. And this 30-year-old man's in custody right now. We are seeing more of these random violent incidents happen that we've ever seen before. And around the country, the crime statistics are going down. That's what they're saying. And we had a huge uptick during COVID, post-COVID. And many are saying most cities are getting back to normal. But there's a couple outliers around the country. And one of those is Seattle. Seattle, especially gun violence, is surging right now. While other cities are seeing a significant decrease, right now that violence in Seattle is going up. In fact, Seattle and Washington, D.C. right now are these two outliers where crime and gun violence are shooting through the roof right now. People are trying to figure out what's happening, what's going on. Why are all these other major cities seeing a significant decrease in this crime, but Seattle is seeing a significant increase? Through the first 3 months of 2024, shots fired incidents are up 26% in Seattle compared to the first quarter last year. Shootings that have hit someone are up 55%. You know, this is obviously 3 months of data. That's not a ton, but when you look into this kind of deeper dive effect and you see the increase that's happening, we got to ask ourselves what's happening and who it's happening with. And who it's happening with is a lot of juveniles. We're seeing a lot of juvenile crime that is surging in our region. And I tell you, we've got to really get ourselves together and ask what's happening here. And really it is dizzying to think that we are even considering shutting down like juvenile detention centers, because I mean, we are hearing about some unbelievably violent crime with 16, 17 year olds in our city right now. In fact, last week in Renton, a 16-year-old who was on electronic home monitoring from an alleged drive-by shooting attempt got a Glock style ghost gun. It was made from a kit with no serial numbers and allegedly used it to shoot and kill a 15-year-old. You know, he's being held in the youth jail, and there are still some out there in our city that are saying, yeah, we don't need a youth jail. You know, let's just keep him on home monitoring and, you know, let's just send him to a one-on-one meeting with a counselor and all will be well. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing a significant crime. And I think there's so many layers here, but a lot of it has to do and parallels with what happened with this, with these COVID lockdowns. I mean, the COVID lockdowns were just a complete disaster, a complete catastrophe. I mean, we went 20 steps back in terms of what it means to be a sane society and hurt youth, kids, in so many incredible ways. I don't even have time to get into that right now. It's just incredible what happened with that. But that's what the Council on Criminal Justice, it's a crime think tank. They've been studying these pandemic spikes and offers a couple unproven theories for why crime went up. But of course, the loss of police legitimacy, people look at the police now and say, people just mock police. Why would I care about what the police are going to do to me? We want to defund them anyways. And I'm not going to respect the police. So there's this police legitimacy issue we have. In fact, we'll talk about that later on in the program. We're going to have Seattle City Council President Sarah Nelson with us. We'll talk with her about that and what's happening here in the Seattle Police Department. And we are hundreds of police officers short here in Seattle. I mean, we should have about 1,500 deployable officers. We have, my goodness, I think we have about 600 or so deployable officers. We are so short. But what do you think, Greg? I mean, why are we in this place right now where we're seeing this surge in violence here in Seattle?
Yeah, particularly among juveniles. You touched on it a bit there, and I think you're spot on. Although another aspect of this is I think it's the lack of impact of fathers in the home. That's one dynamic to this. Two, I don't think these juveniles fear the cops because the police force has been rendered impotent over the past couple of years. And the third thing is they don't fear any repercussions for their actions. I've stated these statistics before on the air, but Renton is in my nape of the way. And just a few weeks ago, they released some numbers about juvenile crime there. This is 2022 compared to 2023. 11 cases of malicious mischief in 2022, 30 in 2023. Stolen vehicle recovery, 22 cases in the year 2022. 61 cases in 2023. Stolen vehicles went from 14 to 63. Assaults, 60 to 84. Assault with firearms, 7 to 15. Armed robbery, 13 to 21. And armed robbery at gas stations, 2 versus 20 in the year 2023.
Wow.
I mean, that's unbelievably striking when you think about it. And so something needs to be done.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's my theory. Those three factors, I think, are playing a heavy role in what we're seeing here.
There's a new transportation levy that's coming on the ballot this fall. Bruce Harrell, our mayor, is pushing this. It's a $1.35 billion transportation levy. Of course, that's with a B. That's a B right there. $1.35 billion over 8 years to improve roads, build new sidewalks, enhance public transit. There's a coalition of community groups pushing for big changes with this transportation levy. There was a huge rally over the weekend that was pushing for housing options and public transportation opportunities for this levy. So many of these people, they're saying, hey, we've got to be able to have more bike lanes. We've got to have more opportunities for walking, more opportunities for riding transit. And it's interesting when I see these protests and these folks come out and advocate for, you know, more bike lanes. I love riding bikes, but I don't know if you've seen in downtown Seattle. I mean, we spent so much money on bike lanes throughout downtown Seattle that if you've been downtown, and I'm downtown all the time, those things are empty. I mean, I rarely see someone biking on those bike lanes that we spent so much money for. You down by Amazon's headquarters down there in South Lake Union, kind of Denny Triangle area. You know, there's some incredible, I mean, some of the nicest bike lanes you'll ever see. I mean, they are beautiful bike lanes.
Coming through.
They're just great bike lanes, and you rarely see anyone using them. I mean, you really do. There are a couple corridors where bike lanes are used back down in like Olympic Sculpture Park along the waterfront. You see people that are kind of riding in through, you know, from Ballard, and they come in, you know, around through the Olympic Sculpture Park. But I tell you, I would say the majority of bike lanes in our city are rarely used. And it is just, it's really incredible to me that we would want to spend billions more on bike lanes when we have such a huge budget crisis. There is so much we need to take out of our budget right now. The city of Seattle, I was talking to a friend who is one of our department heads for the city of Seattle, in one of the departments. And he was mentioning to me just the pork that's there and the waste, the glut that's there. We waste so much money. And so we can do better. We can do a lot better than what we're seeing right now. And this levy that's coming on the ballot this fall, $1.35 billion, it's going to increase your property taxes here in the city. And I tell you, we have never seen a levy that we don't vote yes on. I mean, it just like clockwork. You want more levy? We were, the state of Washington, about 25 years ago, we were, and the city of Seattle, we were in the 20s when it came to cost of living. So in terms of where we ranked in the country in cost of living, and 25 years later, we've risen up to, we're top five. We are one of the top five areas of cost of living in the country. And it's because we're taxing ourselves to death. And so, hey, stay with us. This is Tim Gatos. I'm guest hosting for Brian Suits today. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Brian Suits Show. I'm Tim Gatos, guest hosting for Brian today. Thank you so much for being with us. Good morning to you. Got a great program for you today. Coming up later, City Council President Sarah Nelson will join us. Cliff Mass, one of the notable voices here in the Pacific Northwest, one of the top meteorologists of today. He's got a very well-known blog, and he is not shy about sharing his thoughts, his opinions about what's happening in the region. If you've never seen his blog, you should check it out. But he wrote a few days ago about the University of Washington. He's been at the University of Washington for many years, and he's shared at times about some of the issues happening over there. And he came out with a scathing blog a few days ago. He says the University of Washington has been experiencing some significant problems recently. Of course, we're seeing the anti-Semitism that's happening there. In fact, they are under investigation, the University of Washington, by the federal government because of its anti-Semitism that's happening. That should just kind of wake you up right away, that the University of Washington is under this investigation, and what is happening there. And we're seeing these violent, destructive students doing major damage to the campus student union. But 2 years ago, he says the highly respected, it's called the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE is the acronym. They rated UW as the lowest ranked public university in the nation regarding freedom of speech and expressing diverse views. That is shocking. In some ways, it is shocking. In other ways, it's not. But the lowest rated public university in the nation for freedom of speech. Mass goes on to say, though, that the greatest threat to UW comes from the development of its massive DEI bureaucracy that's draining massive amounts of university funds and pushing policies that make UW an unwelcoming place for those with diverse political and social viewpoints. It's been basically a politicization of a state institution. Mass says the most problematic part of the DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, is the E part, the equity part. He says equity is not equality, which is a core principle of our nation. Equity means equal group outcomes. For example, if 15% of the population is of some ethnicity, race, sex, then 15% of the faculty and students in every program should be of the same ethnicity. Equity means each individual represents their own ethnicity and not themselves as a unique individual. Mask talks about that there is a significant problem from multiple angles around what's happening at the University of Washington. It says if you're a conservative who does not ascribe to the concept of equity, but rather believes in equality, you cannot even get a position at the University of Washington. That the faculty search and how they have put in these, you know, these requirements and how you go about applying for a job, that you have to actually indicate that you are in agreement with all of these DEI principles that they're putting forth. So if you're applying for a job, you have to attest to, yes, I believe this. Yes, this is the, this is how I think. And so basically you, you know, you, anyone who is, has a diverse way of thinking is automatically disqualified from even getting a job at the University of Washington. He says, you know, the UW has become a political monocultural and the DEI juggernaut is rapidly reducing the remaining viewpoint diversity among the faculty. When I read this, I texted a friend of mine who's been a longtime professor at UW, who's an incredible, incredible person. He's been there a long time, highly respected. And I was curious his thoughts on this because he's got an incredible love for UW. He's been there a very long time. And I was like, I wonder. So I sent him the link to this blog and he said, not a surprise. It's like a creeping vine. It wants to take over everything. That was an incredible image, a creeping vine that takes over everything and eventually kind of strangles it out. It reminds me of a little bit of what I've shared when it comes to some of these far left policies that we see and really what, you know, the far left wants to do with our society. They want to see this kind of apocalyptic society. They want to see chaos ensue. And I've been in multiple cases over the years where, you know, because it's cloaked a lot of times in compassion, it's cloaked in care for people
with the best of intentions, so-called.
Yeah, with the best of intentions, so-called. And so there, for me, there's been multiple times where I've been very sympathetic to certain policies or certain ways of thinking because it appears like it's cloaked in compassion and it's cloaked in care for people. And then you realize, oh my gosh, maybe not so much. And it, again, it's like a creeping vine. And now I kind of liken it to a lot of these kind of far left policies. There's really no stopping them. I liken it to kind of if you're nursing a baby alligator back to life, right? And you're like, man, I want to nurse this baby alligator and care for it. It's hurt. But ultimately, that alligator is going to get better and it's going to grow up and it's going to want to kill you. And that I've seen this time and time again with these far left policies where you're like, oh, it's cloaked in compassion. It's cloaked in caring for people. And you're kind of nursing these things. And then you realize, oh, it's growing up. It's growing up. And guess what? It's going to kill you. Right? Like there's no stopping it and there's no satisfying it. There's no satisfying the hunger for chaos. And that's what we see in our society today.
I think I'm an incrementalist at my core, but what we see in this day and age is a series of violent pendulum swings back and forth and gross overcorrections. I'm actually, to compare this to another topic, I'm in the middle of reading Jonathan Haidt's new book, The Anxious Generation. And he talks about how we've gone from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood in America. So he says, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you had children's playgrounds, some of them which were very dangerous, right? You could fall off the top of some toy and break your neck or something like that. But inherent to the design of these playgrounds was you want kids to be able to take some type of risk, right? That's part of how they test their limits and, you know, in, you know, can I develop courage to overcome my fears? And so we realized, well, some of these playgrounds are dangerous, so we're going to correct that, okay? So all the new designs of playgrounds have safety as their most important guiding force. Well, what you lose in doing that is now all these playgrounds have no inherent risk whatsoever, so kids aren't able to test themselves like that. And so, in other words, it's developed their defense mechanisms far more than their discovery mode mechanisms. And I relate that to what goes on at universities with DEI because, okay, like you said, if we pinpointed a flaw in the system, it was that some people have been discriminated against. So, okay, we have to find a cure for that, or we have to find a remedy for that. So then now there's a violent pendulum swing that goes, now we're going to give people preferential treatment because of inalienable characteristics, such as skin pigmentation or sexual orientation or things like that. And so, again, we've just gone way too far as opposed to sort of changing it by varying degrees, and now we've opened up this can of worms that has just been a disaster across the country.
Well, I've said this for years, that it's like a tennis match, a volley, right? It's one size volleys, and each volley gets a little more extreme, and that's why we see the extremes with the right, right? I mean, because the far right is reacting to these incredible exaggerations of the left, the things that we're seeing, right? So it gets a little more extreme with each volley. Every volley back and forth, it gets a little more extreme. And, oh my gosh, can you believe that the left is doing this with DEI? And what, oh my goodness, like that's a new form of racism. And so then volley over becomes a little more extreme, and it just goes back and forth. And it really is, I hope it can moderate itself a little bit.
I think it will. I'm actually hopeful that it will. Right now it is a fairly dark time, but I think it will eventually settle.
Yeah. I tell you, I am so glad to be with you this morning. We've got a great program for you. Stay with us. I'm Tim Gatos. I'm guest hosting for Brian Suits. We'll be right back.